Okay, it gives me a very great pleasure, personal, professional, everything, to introduce one of the keynote speakers whom you'll be hearing at this conference, and that is Professor Imre Zeman, whose keynote is entitled The Cultural Politics of Oil. Now, Imre, Dr. Zeman, is a Canadian research chair in Canadian studies and professor of English, film studies, and sociology at the University of Alberta. Before his work came to deal centrally with oil, he was known to many of us as the person who did more than anyone else to build the field of cultural studies in Canada. He organized its association, the Canadian Association for Cultural Studies. He hosted its first conferences. He is an internationally renowned scholar in the fields of cultural and critical theory, the author of more essays and editor of more key volumes than I could begin to name. He also co-organized the first ever Petrocultures Conference held in 2012 at the University of Alberta, which inspired our own conference here today. He has been a pioneer in the study of petroleum from an interdisciplinary perspective, and that conference would not be happening. This conference would not be happening without his inspiration and collaboration. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Professor Imre Zeman.
Thanks very much, everybody. Given the very interesting presentations today, I feel like I have a lot to say. I feel like I want to respond to a lot of them. And so I'm going to, actually. I'm going to have to say, there's one thing I just really have to say, so I have to get off my chest, and then I'll get going. I think it's really interesting the ways and where we want to put the, where we want to put the demand for change. So often we talk about the necessity for us to act differently as consumers. Sometimes we seem to imagine that government is going to do it through policy. Sometimes it seems to me that this change that we're asking for is really no change at all. It's really trying to mitigate, trying to make some ameliorations to existing systems that perhaps can't do the work that we want of them. For instance, limit increases to global temperature to 2 degrees Celsius or less. And so there might be a larger change that we need than we've heard yet today. That's just a comment. I don't know if that's what I'm going to be talking about today. I also want to say that I want to thank the person who talked about hemp. I think it's really important that we hear from lots of people, and it's good to circulate ideas and to get things into discussion, and it's especially good for to hear from people who might not, might be new to the discussion and might want to share their ideas with us. So, the cultural politics of oil. I know that this might sound like the title of a presentation about the ways that oil has become an object of interest to those in the cultural sphere. So it might be, you might expect that I'm going to go on and on about Neil Young or Daryl Hannah or such things. I'm happy to talk about that in the question period, perhaps. But what I want to talk about here today is a different, broader view of culture and how oil fits into it. Actually, Ken Chapman set me up perfectly, I think, for this talk. Another title for this talk could have been something like An Intro to Energy Humanities, and that's how I'm going to go into it. It could also be called something like What to Do Next, or what kind of changes do we need to make? Perhaps changes other than legislation or regulation. But let me explain what I mean and give me a little bit of time to get going because initially it's going to sound like I'm not talking about oil or energy at all, but I will get there eventually. According to the news, the future is bleak for the humanities. We hear alarming reports about government decisions to cut funding to humanistic and social scientific research because they are viewed as non-strategic, useless, and a waste of money. Think, for example, of the recent threat by the new Australian Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, to shift close to $100 million from humanities to medical research and the ever-dwindling sums committed to supporting humanistic research in the United Kingdom. And then we learn of humanities programs across the world shutting down due to low enrollments. In an age in which the logic of the market dominates, Increasingly debt-burdened students are drawn to those fields that they believe, whether rightly or wrongly, will ensure them an easy transition from tuition fees to paychecks. One response to this grim future is to appeal to the humanities' time-honored virtues in building fundamental skills of communication and expression, skills that are vital to almost any kind of productive human activity. In a November Globe and Mail article, Who Needs the Humanities? Engineers, a young engineer, Michael Ross, makes just this point about the continued necessity and importance of the humanities. Ross points out that fully half of the 12 attributes identified by the Canadian Engineering Accreditation Board as necessary for new engineers are skills that can only be learned in humanities classrooms. Above and beyond skills like life writing and communication, defenders of the humanities also appeal to the fundamental importance of the humanities in shaping ethics and morality, democratic debate and discussion, our understanding of quality of life and the goals of society. Those key critical capacities of a society to ask questions, especially questions about their own practices, hopes, and expectations. In short, without the expertise of the humanities, it is hard to understand our contemporary cultural condition, let alone imagine and enact better futures. And still, we almost always find the humanities crouching defensively, seeking to justify their continued existence against ideological and administrative predators, hungry to redistribute their resources. Engineers might need to learn how to write, but this doesn't mean they need to know much about the history of English literature, no doubt why writing programs have grown at the expense of English departments. As for the more abstract ideas about the good life, for the vast majority of our fellow citizens, the bottom line rules, and ethics and morality are left to tradition, existing political and social systems, or religion. So then, is this really a moment when, as a result of student fears, aggressive actions by governments, and a lack of public interest, the humanities might wither and disappear? I want to present a different future for the humanities here today, and I'd like to do it in relationship to that subject we've been talking about all day, which is oil and energy. For all this bad news about the study of culture, there is an area of humanities. Maybe I'm probably being hopeful here, but anyway, there is an area of humanities research that is being recognized, by the sciences, by government, indeed, if slowly, even by industry. And no wonder. This is an area of research that highlights how the humanities can contribute directly to the solution of an immense real-world social problem, how to find our way towards a sustainable or even renewable energy future. Energy humanities, a term I've coined in conjunction with my colleague Dominic Boyer, who wrote some of the words in this piece. A part of this piece will be forthcoming in the next in the March issue of University Affairs. Energy humanities is a rapidly emerging field of scholarship that, like medical humanities and digital humanities before it, overcomes traditional boundaries between the disciplines and between academic and applied research. Like its predecessors, energy humanities highlights the essential contribution that the insights and methods of the human sciences can make to areas of study and analysis once thought best left to the natural sciences. This isn't a case of the humanities simply helping their cross-cultural, cross-campus colleagues to learn the mechanics of communication so that they might better articulate their ideas. Rather, these fields of scholarship are ones that demonstrate how the scale and complexity of the issues being explored demand the insights and approaches of the humanities. Old school disciplinary boundaries be damned. Energy is a perfect example of an issue that exceeds the traditional division of labor within the university. As the factuality that humanity has entered the Anthropocene sinks in, experts and publics across the world are increasingly wondering, and we are wondering here today as well, how can we cope with a rising demand for energy when our current portfolio of energy sources are already inducing global warming, ocean acidification, and climate change, thus threatening the ecosystems upon which all life depends? An October 2013 report by the World Energy Council, also cited by the present presenters from Synovus, offered two possible scenarios for the energy supply mix. For the energy supply mix that would develop by mid-20th century. So we have two possible scenarios. One is what they call an affordable and accessible scenario, and the other is a sustainable one, with the first, according to them, being more likely to unfold. In the WEC projections, by 2050, we are likely to be using 60% more total energy than we are using today, with the bulk of that increase to come from coal, oil, and gas. Even in the sustainable scenario, this is the better scenario according to WEC, we would still be using 27% more total energy, though hopefully nuclear, biomass, and renewables would make up 37% of the total. Given these numbers, given even the sustainable scenario being one that seems one that should send us into crisis, it is not an exaggeration to wonder about the future of human civilization, at least as we know it. And it has become clear that neither technology nor policy can offer a silver bullet solution to the environmental effects created by an energy-hungry, rapidly modernizing, and rapidly expanding global population. We already have a great deal of the technology we would need to transition to more sustainable or perhaps even renewable renewable forms of energy, even better ones than those mapped out in the WEC's sustainable projections. And policy mechanisms exist as well, at least in theory, which would help accelerate our transition to a renewable future. And yet, greenhouse gas emissions continue to rise and the environment continues to become more toxic. The fact is that technology and policy find themselves in an impasse that they alone cannot solve. When it comes to energy in relation to social practices and behavior, knowledge doesn't seem to be translating into the kind of action we might hope it to. What we energy humanists are arguing is that today's energy and environmental dilemmas are fundamentally problems of ethics, habits, values, institutions, belief, and power, all traditional areas of expertise of the humanities and humanistic social sciences. One of the key impasses afflicting humanity, it seems to me, when it comes to energy, that gap between knowledge and action, insight and involvement, the amazing difficulty of pushing the supertanker of our civilizational infrastructure in a new direction fast enough to avoid crashing on a reef of our own design, this impasse is one that has been repeatedly addressed in post-Enlightenment humanistic thinking. There is no automatic connection between knowing and acting, not for individuals and not for societies either, which can exhibit the same forms of impulsive behaviors, addictions, conservatism, and laziness as individuals do, often acting against their own interests in much the same way. We too easily give ourselves over to ideas of human progress that date back to the work of, say, Immanuel Kant, who imagined that as humanity moved through time, it necessarily matured, growing up from an eager child bent on destruction of everything in front of him to a rational adult who at long last knows how to run their own lives in an orderly, predictable, and ethical fashion. As someone who just went through a divorce, I can tell you that that's not how it works. Progress is a wonderful tale. Progress is a wonderful tale, one that is incredibly difficult for us to shake out of our heads. A narrative that fills history with a purpose and significance it otherwise doesn't possess. Which isn't to say that it and other social narratives don't have immense power. What it does mean, however, is that it is important for us to understand the complex dynamics of the social and cultural narratives that guide and shape us. And so it means, too, that solving the dilemma of our energy impasse, that gap that we saw already today between all of this knowledge we have and then the inability to answer that question that I can't answer either when somebody says, what do we do? This impasse requires the involvement of the humanities, we need economists. Of course we need economists. I learned enormous amounts from them. We need people who are involved in policy. Of course we need those people as well. We need technology as well. But those are not magic bullet solutions. We need the humanities as a forerunner researching the cultural landscape around us and imagining the future relationship between energy and society towards which we need to strive. Without greater insight into the ways in which ethics, values, habits, institutions, beliefs, and power shape our relation to energy, it is unfortunately all too likely that we'll lazily opt for the EC's affordable and accessible scenario, the one in which we end up using 60% more energy, instead of moving towards being sustainable and never then get to where we need to be in the constitution of our future social lives. The good news, I think, is that this is not just a story we humanists are telling about ourselves. When we energy humanists start talking with scientists, engineers, government officials, and even members of the energy industry, we often discover that they've been waiting for us to arrive. By the way, you should come and see me if you are waiting for me to arrive. Those who are closest to the blunt necessity of energy for our complex modern societies, an increasingly wireless world still feeding on the remnants of organisms millions of years old, those who are closest to this question, those of us in Alberta, perhaps, those of us in the industry, those of us who study the industry, are aware of the enormous challenges of mitigating the environmental effects of energy use. They're looking for change. But when it comes to how they might participate in change, or how the public might react to policies that might well necessitate significant transformations in their daily lives, they realize they don't know what to do. And they realize perhaps they need insight from a group of folks that they tend to ignore, people in the humanities. At the first Petrocultures Conference in Edmonton, attendees included members of industry and government, there for the purpose of understanding what energy humanists could tell them, for example, about representations of climate change, or the link between existing social practices and energy regimes. And my colleagues in the STEM fields are also starting to understand how the humanities might contribute to their work. In these fields, those in these fields understand very well the stakes of anthropogenic climate change. And they also understand that no impactful scientific or engineering remediation could take place without deeper attention to the human factors inhibiting energy transition and the uptake of new technology. To quiet the concern from my own colleagues in the humanities that what I'm trying to do and what some of us in this room are trying to do is just a new kind of applied research or a kind of humanistic consulting work, though I will do that as well, energy humanities is already producing theoretical takeaways that any hardcore scholar would love. So, for example, historian Timothy Mitchell's book Carbon Democracy Project, for instance, he talks about the ways in which the Keynesian model of growth, which I think we are still fantasizing will return to us, it's just kind of gone away for a little while, and soon enough the middle class will return in the way that we imagined it. He has a very extended analysis of the ways in which this idea of growth depended fundamentally on a cultural understanding of oil as an inexhaustible, inexpensive resource, sort of one that costs around $2 a barrel instead of 100 plus. And this book has had an incredible impact across the disciplines. My colleague Stephanie Limonanger's book, she's here and we'll be talking tomorrow, her book Living Oil, Petroleum and Culture in the American Century, constitutes a rich archive of the omnipresence of petroleum in daily life and the way in which energy shapes affect, belief, belonging. Well, in another recent book on the American way of life, an American way of life that everybody in the world wants to adopt, still, geographer Matthew Huber traces in detail the multiple ways in which an existence organized around property, mobility, and entrepreneurship is linked directly to the presence of cheap and seemingly inexhaustible forms of energy. It's become clear from these and the growing number of rich contributions to the study of energy. Another one, for instance, is philosopher Timothy Morton's book, Hyperobjects, which was reviewed in Newsweek, of all places. It's become clear from these contributions that we can no longer fully understand developments in culture, society, politics, and economics without paying attention to the role played by energy in each. And there are all kinds of real-world interventions taking place, too, especially in film and the visual arts. So here comes in some of the more traditional sides of what culture might mean. Over the past decade, a large number of films have critically examined our relation to energy, such as Werner Herzog's Lessons of Darkness, artist Ursula Beeman's Black Sea Files, and Josh Fox's controversial Gasland. In the visual arts, of course, there's Edward Bertinsky's photo essay Oil and Marina Zurkow's video installation Mesocosm. And they've joined big exhibits, such as the Oil Show at HMKV in Dortmund, that have interrogated our civilizational dependence on a single source of energy. More recently, I think the visual arts have shown their capability to creatively engage this impasse between knowledge and action that I've been speaking to, especially in such new projects, both represented in this conference, new projects such as Brenda Longfellow's Offshore and David Dufresne's Fort McMoney, both of which pioneer kind of a genre of online documentary film game in order to try to get at publics in a very, very different way than a traditional documentary might. Let me also make here a quick plug for a new international multidisciplinary project on oil in which I'm involved, or I'm starting to be involved, or it's at the beginning, which is called After Oil, the Future Cultures Project. This project has no animus against oil. It's absolutely true that we depend on it, we continue to use it, we are oil subjects, we are people of oil. This project begins, in fact, from that assumption that we're petrol cultures. We're petro societies, petro subjects. We're life forms whose physical world, worldviews, self-understanding, and social expectations have developed in conjunction with a cheap, readily available, and powerful source of energy, which is oil. Oil is not just some kind of input, an energy input to the system that can easily be changed to some other input without a major change in our social formation. We are petro subjects, we're petro cultures, member of petro cultures. And the problem is that this resource is not unlimited in the way we imagine it as petro subjects. And it also, as many have pointed out today, its ongoing unchecked use will guarantee ecological catastrophe. Hence, the pressing need for contemporary societies to find and embrace new forms of energy, but also to imagine and produce the socio-cultural practices they will require. The aim of this project, this group project After Oil, is to rigorously examine the connections between energy, society, and culture in order to more fully map out the challenges of the global transition from oil to other kinds of fuels. What we ask in this project is, if energy fundamentally shapes society, what impact and repercussions might energy transition entail? And how might an understanding of the deep links between ubiquitous energy modes and dominant social cultural forms illuminate the changes necessary in the passage to a sustainable energy future? What those of us who are involved in After Oil are especially interested in is, in fact, this problem of energy impasse that I've touched on several times today. What we mean by this impasse is those limits or blockages that prevent any move toward, indeed, any even real imagination of a world after oil. I don't think we're imagining this. I think we're very concerned, and I don't think we're really imagining it. We're petro subjects to the core. It's difficult for us. Impasse is a constitutive feature of contemporary oil societies, denoting an inability or failure to envision or affect significant social transformation at the scale or speed demanded by circumstances, despite pressing, and as many have pointed out, irrefutable knowledge of the need for change. We know we must change. We know change will happen whether we want it to or not. But so far, we have little way of imagining how change will unfold or any real understanding of what could come about as a result of the passage from fossil fuel to some sustainable alternative. How might research in the humanities and social sciences enable us to more effectively to address those impasses that have prevented serious social engagement with the problem of energy transition? And in what ways and through what forms might the knowledge produced by academic research on energy impasse and transition best be mobilized to inspire audiences, including academics, policymakers, and members of the general public, to grapple with the circumstances we confront? We take these questions about the mobilization of the knowledge that we'll find out about energy very seriously. And this is why in this project we've partnered with museums, galleries, and exhibition spaces around the world to see if we might not figure out a way to turn what we learn about energy impasse into a way of shattering the gap between what we know and what we have to do when it comes to how we live with and through energy. in an article, in a very brief article called Meet the Humanities, Mike Holm, a professor of climate change, notes that the research cited for the third intergovernmental panel on climate change, and this hasn't changed in the fifth, I have to say, was dominated by the natural sciences. The small amount of social science material that was included came almost exclusively from economics. With few small exceptions, the humanities were completely absent. Holm, this is, remember, from a climate change scientist, thinks this is a big mistake, and I obviously do too. We can only solve our current energy and environmental dilemmas by making humanistic research part of the conversation, and not just a part, but a big part. And once these contributions to the fight against climate change are given the credit they are due, it may be that much easier to persuade anxious students and skeptical politicians that the humanities are absolutely strategic and vital to how we relate to and understand energy, and are vital, too, to the future of the planet. Thanks.
Well, as someone tweeted while Imre was talking, that was deep, eloquent, and real. Thank you very much. We have some time for questions, about 10 minutes, so please go to the microphone. I'll repeat the earlier instructions. Please, one question per customer. They should really be questions, ideally. So would you like... Ideally, really, okay.
Hi, my name's Kayla. I'm an English literature student at McGill. So very much part of the humanities. And I think part of the reason why it's very difficult to incorporate humanity research when we're dealing with issues about the environmental crisis is that we're often in the abstract in humanities. And doing English literature, this is kind of, you know, we're talking not really kind of real-world implications. So my question to you is, how can we kind of bridge, how can humanities kind of take that leadership role in bridging the gap between, you know, what's often known as kind of dogmatic and romantic ideologies and, you know, really apply them to these real-world issues?
Well, this is the question, isn't it? I don't know if there's a how. What I would say is it's important to be part of the conversation. So I'll give you an example, and I'll take it from Matthew Huber's book. Matthew Huber points out that one of the key values to how all of us here, I will generalize. You can come up after and say, I don't have that value, that's fine. I will generalize. We have a value of mobility. We believe that mobility is important for selfhood. We believe that it's important to define who and what we are. We would not want to be in a situation or in a culture where we wouldn't be able to move around. Now, what I think is important for the humanities to be able to do is to show all of the ways in which that occurs and how that comes up and the complexity of it. So my colleague Patricia Yeager, for instance, pointed out the ways in which the Beat generation of writers, they're driving around the countryside, they're like expressing their masculinity, and she says in On the Road, in Kerouac's On the Road, she doesn't ever remember them actually filling up the car. Like, they don't have to stop, and it's kind of like, you know, another version of On the Road would be like they're driving and they're like riffing and on their things, and they're like, oh, I'm running out of gas, got to get some gas again. Jesus, what the hell is going on with this? Like, gas kills our car. But they don't do that, because what's at the core of it is this kind of sensibility of mobility. And I think it's important for us to enter this into the conversation so that we understand why there's this difficulty of making a decision. The way we do it now is we say people should move around less. Individuals should make the decision not to move. Right? Individuals shouldn't fly here. All of us should be Skyping in. We should have this giant Skype discussion about oil because we're bad subjects now for having come here. And I think that's the wrong way to do it. I also think, I'm not sure how governments would be able to do that. Governments would somehow impose in a totalitarian way that we don't move around. Well, they do it in a certain way. Of course, they can do it through pricing. It doesn't seem to have done very much, and that's because mobility is such an essential component of how we are and what we believe. So what I would say as somebody in the humanities, you can contribute by explaining and showing to us the ways in which that emerges, how that comes to be. Because again, I think we have this tendency to not understand ourselves as petro-subjects, And so our tendency would be to think, always we thought mobility was essential to selfhood. Always we thought that mobility was a key component of every social formation. And it just wasn't. It's not the case. Does that come to solve policy? No, but it enriches the discussion and the debate in a very, very crucial way. Because otherwise I feel like if we don't have this extended analysis, humanities-style analysis of beliefs, behaviors, and affects, we're going to constantly be stuck in a situation where my extremely capable, extremely smart colleagues, like the economists on the first panel, are going to have people like me coming up to say, what are we going to do about it? You know, I feel like I want them to tell me, and of course they can't tell me. It's an incredibly complicated situation. But I don't believe that we can rely on technology. I don't think that suddenly we're going to come up with a new fuel source to save us. Nor do I think that policy will enable it. And policy won't enable it because we will have a reaction if that policy is about limitation.
We talked about that beforehand.
I'll go with it a little bit. So I think we'll, since Amory's giving such long answers, we'll just stick with the four people there and there. So.
Okay. I'm Jennifer Wenzel.
Oh, wait, I meant to mention Jennifer's work, too.
I'm Jennifer Wenzel. I teach English at the University of Michigan, and I've been involved in the environmental humanities, and I guess without knowing it, also in the energy humanities. So, Amory, I wanted to ask you about moments in two talks that we've heard today that both invoke the idea of game over. The first was game over, right? One was a reference, a kind of critical and skeptical reference to James Hansen's idea that combusting all of the oil in the tar sands would mean game over for the climate, not for the planet, as was said. And what Ken Chapman said today, that I can work with people as long as they're in the position of uncertainty. It's when they become indifferent that it's game over. And I was really struck by the relationships between those two statements of game over, one being a kind of physical, scientific one, and another being an affective and cultural one. And it seems like what you're saying is not so much the kind of game over moment as a kind of computer crash or, you know, the machine is frozen moment and you don't even get to finish the game. And so I'm wondering a couple things. One is, what role does game over thinking play in this impasse that you're thinking about? How does that make it harder to think through the impasse? And how does that question of impact kind of play out differently in terms of where you started your talk, in terms of the different levels of change that are necessary from the consumer to policy to kind of global systems?
Always with the easy questions.
Yeah.
So let me start with Ken's comment. I thought what Ken was saying is that when one becomes fixed in their beliefs, then it's extremely difficult to mobilize change. And I worry that we're getting to that space. I worry that the survey results presented by Liz, it makes me nervous to suggest that publics don't want to engage in this. It may be that publics don't want to engage in lots of social change. That makes me very, very nervous, because then it becomes difficult to produce the kinds of change. Again, we're talking about at a scale and a speed that we don't have any experience with, except through quite violent action. And I don't think policy does it. I've been very heartened by the optimism of the panelists today about carbon taxes. I've been very heartened. I wonder if it can go quick enough, and I wonder if it kind of sets up, given what we heard from Synovus about this kind of expert community versus the general public, that makes me very nervous. So that's one kind of change in relation to energy impasse. The second is James Hansen's, which I heard in Satya Das's comments about you can tell me after if I got you wrong, but let's now, he's probably right about the fact that we're not going to we're not going to go under 2 degrees Celsius. So now we do what Hansen himself hasn't said, but others have said in the scientific community, let's just get at, let's realize we've made anthropocenic climate change, and let's work with the world that way. That again, to me, suggests an expert community that is split off from a public or from a democratic community that's doing interventions on a technological basis in a way that makes me very nervous. I'm not answering your question, but those are kind of, I guess those two game overs point to something like Bill Gates' comments in his editorial in the December issue, this past December issue of Wired, where he essentially was imploring the technological community and the business community to go about creating social change because governments can't. And he's very direct about this, frankly. And he has a very strong feeling that there's a kind of technological utopianism and then technology will change us and that we can get car... I mean, I don't buy it. So I have very strong views about this. You can just look at the most recent issue of Policy Options. I have an essay about technology. I'll leave it there.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Lemonager, and thank you, Emery, for mentioning my book. You've been a wonderful resource for so many years for me. I wanted to ask you a question that's related to the After Oil Project and also to my understanding of a lot of the work that you've done partnering with artists or working with the visual arts. I think about your work with Ursula Beaumont and some of your own photography, actually, and photography essays. With this sort of new surge toward interdisciplinary conversation amongst humanists and also between humanists and people in the sciences and social sciences, it seems like one of the big questions that I've had anyway is how do we design humanist research and the kinds of knowledge and the kinds of affects we produce in a way that really moves effectively across our own disciplinary fields and then even farther afield? And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit to that question of design, perhaps bringing in some of the collaborative work you've done with artists.
The answer is I don't know. And part of the After Oil Project is, in fact, to take that head on. So we don't want to do academic research that then we somehow exhibit in an art museum. Mm-hmm. We're very, very conscious, as are people that run museums and galleries, that certain people go to museums and galleries and people take in knowledge in a certain way in a museum and gallery, but they're the ones that have some expertise about presentation, and so they're as interested as we are in trying to figure out how to address exactly those questions. So, and it isn't exactly, I don't know, like moving into the street. It's not quite any of those things. It's about taking seriously the idea of how do you get publics interested. I mean, maybe that's what fundamentally the issue is. And when I see work like Brenda Longfellow's, I don't know if she's here, but when I showed that to my son, he was immediately interested. He could navigate it in a way that he was not as interested in her earlier work, even though it was also messing around with form and messing around with the way you communicate a message. And I think part of it is that it's so part of what has been frustrating to me is that we don't really want to. Here's the difficulty. We don't really want to communicate a message like about. I don't feel like saying, don't use oil. I'm not sure where that goes. I think what we want to say is, how do you make a society over into something else? And we haven't done that, frankly. We have the models we have are not good ones. Like the Khmer Rouge have some experience about that. That's not a good one. I'm not joking. Like so that's what we're all demanding of ourselves. And I don't think that's through how you change purchasing behavior, because the problem there is that you're still engaging in purchasing behavior, and it's not that I'm against purchasing. It's just that that's not the site of the activity. It's so much more complicated and deeper. And I'm not pretending to have answers. I just think that we have to admit those questions into the discussion and debate about oil. That would be my inadequate answer.
Okay, can we have two quite quick questions, if you don't mind, because we have another event at another venue at 5:30, so.
Sure. Hi, my name is Thomas. I'm a student at McGill in Environment, and I'm also here with Divest McGill. So I guess I'm going to kind of echo some of the other questions, but with a sort of different framework. You talked about the gap between what we know is happening and sort of what we're actually talking about doing, and sort of how we're not really envisioning what the future is actually going to look like. The way I tend to think of this is in terms of uncertainty and the fact that, like, there is a lot of uncertainty involved in what we're talking about, and that is sort of used often as an argument against any sort of action whenever a party who's involved might disagree with you know what's going on. So I guess my question is energy humanities what you're talking about? Is it also taking into account sort of how do we go into these questions or these discussions with how do we use the what we have and the uncertainties that we have, take them into account and still act on them and not be like sort of stuck in place. Or is it more of another sort of like gaining more information and reducing that uncertainty?
I think it's gaining information somewhere else. That's what it is. So as my much more capable colleagues in sciences and in economics, I learned from them today, they have enormous information about what's happening. How do we act it? How do we activate it? We don't know how those are connected. And so it's about really taking that head on. If for instance, we our political system is inadequate to it because it's a four-year cycle or a three-year cycle or a five-year cycle, and the cycle that we're talking about is on a much larger scale and likely to produce unhappiness rather than the happiness necessary to win back Quebec for the PCs or whatever, how do we reimagine a political system? I mean, this then seems people throw up their hands saying, that's impossible. Well, then, that's not an answer. If one is serious about the challenges facing us. So I would just say pressing against that. And certainty, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm constantly uncertain. I'm constantly unaware. I don't know what to do about this. But I want to look at where I think the better... Having lots of information of what's happening to us, I want to know why it is that there seems to be publicly zero uptake on the latest IPCC report. Nothing in the media. And the IPCC report, the third IPCC report, when there was a poll in the UK 3 months following, more people in the UK were skeptical that climate change was going on. I want to understand that. So we will have some behavioral psychologists as part of our group as well, who are looking at the ways in which you try to better communicate knowledge. I mean, myself included, I'm a university professor. I think you do a lecture and your students know everything, and they've changed their minds. It's like I'm Robin Williams in like bad movie, right? Unless you like that movie, in which case it's good. I think that kind of having that sense that what we know has a really complicated relationship to the nature of the social change we need to do, and so we need a lot of different kinds of information than has been included. Because I think when we get IPCC 3, IPCC 4, IPCC 5, fantastic, who could argue? I'm absolutely not arguing against this, but it's kind of this sense of like, now it's 98%, 99% certainty. That's not a moment of change, actually. That's not how a society operates. That's not how we operate. It's like when I tell my son, you should go to sleep early because it's good for you. You won't be tired in the morning. He has never, ever gone to sleep early. Okay? He's always tired in the morning. So granted, a teenage boy is not the best test case for impasses of knowledge to action, but there's other ones as well, right?
Thank you.
Quickly, please, if you don't mind. As quick as I can. I'm Oliver Hobson, London, Ontario, home of the Honourable Joe Fontana, and next-door neighbour of Rob Ford. So, the corporation, Joel Bacon, Vancouver, very good movie, watched it years ago, took the concept of a corporation being a person under the law, put it on the couch, and diagnosed it as being psychotic from the way it was born, from the where it came out. So what sort of student does a psychopath or a sociopath make in humanities? What sort of humanities student would it make?
Interesting. So it, because you imagine that, that would be the site of the change, what sort of social... I have a number of sociopathic students that are sitting at the back there. They're here with me. That's an excellent question. I mean, you're absolutely drawing attention to the nature of the change. So where it has to occur, what kinds of institutions we're addressing, you know, what I mean, I'll kind of back away from what you're saying to give a different example. Only because I don't know how to answer your question, but when you think about just kind of inherited built space of cities, okay, they do not work well with a different energy regime, especially Canadian cities. We are absolutely incompetent at building cities. So how do we think that now, and how do we think habit in relation to that? Well, we don't. We don't kind of have any kind of relationship to develop. We don't kind of make limits on developers. Young couples or individuals, they need a house, and things on the edge of town are way cheaper. Then they need highways, then they need schools. I mean, it's just kind of this kind of endless cycle, though we also know the report of IPCC 3, 4, 5. So I guess there needs to be some kind of way of thinking those relations that go beyond policy, that may affect policy, that go beyond existing social formations, political formations, that require amazing transformations of those social formations and political formations. But those are difficult things. I just think that that has to be entered into any discussion. Otherwise, we're not really addressing that larger question that is on a very large scale, but it's also much closer to us than we are allowing it to be in many discussions about energy and oil.
I'm just going to tell you where to go next before we officially thank Imre. And the Dead Poets Society's fans are going crazy on Twitter. But so this marks the end of our official activities for today, but we have some wonderful things in store for you this evening. I invite you all to make your way to the McCord Museum, which is located just a few blocks east. Well, maybe that's not east. I think that way is east. At 690 Sherbrooke Street West, where we're going to have basically what we're calling our cultural evening, featuring the work of artists from across Canada whose work has been influenced by oil, hosted by journalist Martin Petriquin. You're going to see some reading and film clips from filmmaker and author Warren Carew, some poetry, a theatrical performance from McGill Theatre students, and the music of Canadiana country cowboy Tim Huss, who, if you caught his performance at MISC a couple of years ago, is amazing. Darren Barney will confirm that. And then we invite you to stay and enjoy our opening cocktail. Now, one important thing, the cultural event can only accommodate 100 people, so please get there in time to get a seat. It's supposed to start at 5:30. Maybe we can hold off for 4 or 5 minutes. If by any chance you are unable to get a seat in the room, you're still welcome to join us for the reception, which will immediately follow the cocktail at 7:15. I'd like, though, to ask you to join me in thanking Imre for not just the vision that helped make this conference possible, but for an extremely interesting, rich, and reflective talk. So please join me.